I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday afternoon. This hour, very excited to talk about Rosetta, the first spacecraft to rendezvous with a comet, Comet 67P, and land a rover to gather data. And evidently, there has been quite a bit of data recovered as the lander is in a dormant position now, with hopes that as it gets closer to the sun, it will come alive again. This hour, Dr. Claudia Alexander is with us, project scientist for the U.S. portion of the International Rosetta Mission. She was also the project staff scientist for the Cassini and the final project manager of the Galileo mission. She's a member of the technical staff, has been, at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and her studies include the evolution and interior physics of comets, Jupiter and its moons, magnetospheres, plate tectonics, space plasma, the solar wind, and the planet Venus. She has a bachelor's in geophysics from UC Berkeley, a master's in geophysics and space physics at UCLA, and her PhD from Michigan in atmospheric, oceanic, and space sciences, specializing in space plasma. She's a woman of many talents. She's written many children's books, is a huge tennis fan, and says her best memory at Michigan was staying up all night with friends arguing about which one of us was going to do the most for mankind. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I know there was great interest in this mission and continues to be, so feel free to call in during this hour. We're anxious to take your calls as well. The phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Dr. Alexander was in Germany last week with her counterparts with the European Space Agency. She was there when the spacecraft landed on the comet's surface. And Claudia Alexander, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I can't imagine what that moment must have been for you, because it was so many years you waited for this moment to take place, right?
I mean, literally, you would think, you wouldn't even think about it. It was so far over the horizon. You'd be like, yeah, one day we're going to land on the comet. You know, and then, I guess in the 30 days leading up to it, it really started to crystallize as this is really going to happen, especially after the last go, no-go on October 12th was issued as a go, because then there was nothing else we could do to change it, right? It's like, mm-hmm. The landing site, which looked horrible, all these rocky, weird things were there, and we couldn't change that. And that's when I think everybody's anxiety level really went up.
When it was launched 10 years ago, Dr. Alexander, was it given a 50-50 chance, or was everybody enormously hopeful that it was going to land?
No, it was always risky.
Yeah.
Starting with... we had to change targets. We had to launch the rocket that was going to launch us had problems. So we said, we'll take a break. You fix the rocket, and we'll pick a new target. And the new target was bigger, so the landing people were really concerned that there was more gravity, that the shock absorbers, let's say, weren't designed for such a large object that might break. But I think that was when they tried to put this this little jet pack on to try to hold it down.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been a huge risk.
And to get there, please tell us about the science behind this three gravity assist flybys of Earth and one of Mars to get it on its course. I can't even imagine the calculations that took place for that to happen. They must have been very complex.
Yeah, I mean, ever since I think it was invented for the Galileo mission, these looping around the solar system, trying to build up speed to get out to the outer solar system.
Mm.
And ever since then, somebody at Caltech came up with it for Voyager. I'm wrong. It was not Galileo. It was Voyager. But ever since then, it's been part of what we use, right, part of our toolbox. So, yes, the calculations are incredibly complex. But we're thankful, because these are things that assist us in getting out to the outer solar system.
Mm-hmm. And Rosetta went to sleep, is this right, for about 3 years?
Yeah, that is unheard of. Now, that was a major risk.
Was it?
Okay? Because they turned the spacecraft off.
Wow.
And without even a beacon that would emit periodically to say, here we are. And again, it's because we had to change targets, and the new comet meant we had to go farther out towards Jupiter than we ever expected. And we didn't want to freeze to death. You know, we only have solar panels. The Europeans are adamant we will not put anything radioactive on the spacecraft to help warm us up and keep us warm. So solar panels out near Jupiter, you know, you're going to freeze. So they shut everything off to try to preserve power to keep the instruments warm through that three-year hibernation. That was very risky.
And you had no idea, really, what was happening to it at that time, did you?
None.
Nothing.
No idea, okay? So we had all sorts of nightmare scenarios. I'm sure that for people who have teenagers who have broken curfew and stayed out later than they were supposed to, you have this nightmare scenario of what could be going wrong, right? And we just imagined all the failures we've had. You know, the guy I work with, he had worked on a project that they had a near Earth, something orbiting Earth that they lost, and they couldn't find it for a week. And we're just thinking, what if it's way out there, and if it can't find us, what it was supposed to do was spiral wider and wider to try to find us. And what if it's just strobing, out there strobing, where's Earth, where's Earth, you know, as we try to look for it. And so when the time came and the signal was supposed to come down and the signal was late, we had those panicked moments. You know, again, that was another panic moment of, oh, my God, you know, what are we going to have to do now to try to find Rosetta? But fortunately, Rosetta was only 45 minutes late, called in. you know, what had happened was it had a spacecraft anomaly while it was trying to look for Earth. Something had gone wrong, and it had to shut itself down and restart itself again. And that's why it was late. So we're like, oh, well, that's okay.
when you think about it, only 45 minutes late after 10 years,
for heaven's sake. That's really good point. Exactly. Right.
So when the mission was conceived back in the late 70s, what was the idea of it, Dr. Alexander? What did people hope? Why do this?
Yeah, this is a European idea. They have, especially in Switzerland, really, really wanted to get the fundamental material that the solar system is made out of. And it all started, actually, with the Apollo program. They convinced NASA with the astronauts to take a piece of foil that was to measure the solar wind. And, of course, we didn't even know the sun had a wind, right? But, again, that was, we think the sun, if we could measure what the sun puts out, that'll tell us what this original material is of the solar system. And ever since then, they go around measuring things, and ever since then they've wanted to get a piece of a comet. And that was partly the impetus behind the Giotto mission, which is a European mission to Comet Halley. And they said, look, comets are ours. NASA, you can have the rest of the solar system. We want to be able to focus on comets and understand the solar system origins.
There was, Rebecca sent us a Facebook message, and there was news, BBC reporting yesterday, that the lander had detected organic molecules on the surface of the comet, carbon-containing organics, of course, the basis of life on Earth. Rebecca writes, she heard that the comet may have organic molecules. Maybe we can learn where we really come from. Maybe we're all aliens.
Yeah. Isn't that fascinating news?
Yes, I would say so.
I mean, I'm thrilled. Okay, so one of the reasons why it's so fascinating is because we've never before detected organics on a comet, even though we think they should be there. You sort of think you're at home in your office and you're thinking about comets and you're thinking they're out in the deep freeze of space and they have this original material and they have carbon. Why wouldn't we have, you know, long carbon chains of these organic style molecules? And so then you'd go to your telescope and you'd look, or comets would come in towards the Earth like Siding Spring or Comet Ison that was last year, and you'd look at the spectra and you wouldn't see any organics. And so that was a head scratcher. You know, why are we not seeing these things in the spectra? Partly maybe we have to go up close and personal. Maybe by the time the material is ejected into the atmosphere of a comet, maybe they break apart and you can't tell that the daughter products are there, and you can't tell that there was a parent giant organic molecule. So this kind of confirms what we would hope to have found, and it's really gratifying to have found them, okay, mm-hmm. and exciting.
And scientists, I understand, had to perform as many key tests as they could because the battery, of course, life ran out at the weekend with hopes that it will, as it gets closer to the sun, come alive again. How many tests were performed? What are we going to be learning about the data we already have?
Yeah, I mean, they were able to run all the tests, which is fantastic. I remember writing a report to our center director to tell him that 8 of the 10 experiments had run, and this was perhaps with maybe 10 hours left.
Oh, my.
And then we got on an airplane, right, and I'm flying from Frankfurt to San Francisco, and I had a layover. And so, of course, I jump on Twitter. Where would we be without Twitter
right.
these days? And I see that in the last, they have an hour left. The battery is going through its steep decline, right? The battery kind of is going a little flat, but at some point it's going to start tailing off, and it had tailed off, and it was in its steep decline. So we've got minutes left, and they're trying to download all the data. They had run now all the experiments, and I was surprised because they were concerned about drilling, that if they drilled, that would move it with, you know, action-reaction. If you're not anchored properly and you try to run the drill, that you would just push yourself out of that little whatever we found ourselves in, the crevasse,
mm-hmm.
And you wouldn't complete the experiment and you'd be in unknown territory. And at that point in time, they really wanted to sort of try to get all the experiments complete and then hope that the battery can come back. So they must have decided to go for it. Evidently, the lander was held in position well enough by whatever crevasse that it found itself in. Thank goodness. You know, I think that crevasse is just incredible good luck for us.
You do?
In so many ways.
Oh.
Yeah. I think it's a better scientifically, a better location than the original plot of ground. You know, we put that plot for landing safety reasons, not for its scientifically interesting components. And we ended up in the crevasse, which to me had incredible, we learned an incredible amount being in there. And so just to complete the story about how all the experiments got to run, it looks like they did drill, that the drilling went down, picked up a sample, or we think it executed what it was supposed to do to have picked up a sample, and put the sample into the ovens, and then two of the mass spectrometers, which are supposed to, you know, sniff, basically, they cook the stuff and let the vapors go out, and then the mass spectrometers are like noses. They smell, you know, I know I use my nose at Thanksgiving time. I can tell when the stuff is in the oven and when it's ready and when it's,
right.
you know, I can tell what's going on in there. So, so we're waiting to see what's the quality. I've heard different reports about whether or not the drill, even though it went down and it looked like it did everything, like go down, come up, rotate to the position of the oven, put stuff in the oven, it's not clear how much stuff it actually retrieved from the surface.
I see.
And one of the curious and, for us, learning experiences is that the surface is much harder than we expected,
mm-hmm.
Which is a real head-scratcher because, in other respects, the comet appears to be an incredibly low-dense, porous, fluffy material.
Hmm.
So, you know, it's now it's physics time, right? Now you go back to the drawing board and you try to figure out what kind of physics gives you this stuff.
Right. And what are your hopes as to whether or not the fillet will come alive again? When would it? And do you think, what's the scientific consensus on that?
Yeah, it's in it's in a low power state. So I don't know about you, but I have teenage nieces and nephews, and they like to run their cell phones down to 1%.
Yes.
And I like to go to charger at 20%. And they're like, you
right.
old people, you don't take risks, you know. Well, you know, so the lander is on some sort of low power state. It's in the red, but it's not completely off. And the thinking is that as we get closer to the sun, it will get, it's a matter of how long it will take to charge up, since a lot of the solar cells are in shadow. So the ones that are in the sun will be, it'll just take longer to recharge. But maybe around March 2015, it will start to recharge. But just like your computer or your cell phone, it gets in that low power state. When you're charging it back up to some nominal state, in those early points, you can't really do anything with your computer until it gets past a certain point.
Right, right.
So so about March, we think it'll start recharging again. We might be able to communicate with it. It'll have enough power to send a communication ping. But in the midsummer, we expect we might have enough power to actually run experiments again.
Mm.
So that would be tremendously exciting. Again, luck. Originally, by March 2015, it was going to be too hot at the original site for the lander to operate. Now you're in, you know how your computer's battery is like it's going to set your pants on fire,
mm-hmm.
right? And the fan is running, and finally the computer gives up because mm-hmm. the battery is too hot. So, and originally, the original plan was that the lander would get too hot, and the comet hasn't even, is nowhere near its closest approach to the sun, and the lander's already dead. So now it looks like the close approach to the sun is August 2015, the closest point. So if we're able to do experiments in July, let's say,
right.
Potentially even the surface could be softer, and potentially we could run that experiment again with the drill,
right.
and we might get more material, and boy, that would really teach us a lot.
Right. And I guess we just don't know, because who in the world has ever been there before?
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. That's why you send, that's why you go exploring.
Right? Yeah. Let's welcome phone calls. We'll take them in just one moment. We're talking this hour of the program with Dr. Claudia Alexander, project manager and project scientist of the U.S. Rosetta Project. And she is here to talk about, she was in Germany when Philae landed on the comet last week, which was just this extraordinary moment. We played, I remember, the sound. And somebody has a question about the sound, too, which I played over and over again because I was thinking, as I was playing it, nobody has ever heard this before. It is so far away, and it was so hard to get to. Here's our number for all of your questions for her about this remarkable mission, what we've already been able to determine about the comet, what our hopes are for getting more information, and what it took to get there. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking, we're having a terrific conversation with Dr. Claudia Alexander, project manager, project scientist of the U.S., component of the European Space Agency Rosetta Project, and welcoming your phone calls. Our lines are filled. Just keep the number in mind. Let's go to Carol in Oak Creek first. Hi, Carol.
Oh, couldn't hear you. Thank you. How do you make sure that the organic molecules found are actually from the comet and not from contaminations humans may have introduced while building and touching the probe? So I'm wondering, how do you know that the organic molecules are extraterrestrial and not from human contamination?
Mm.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Carol.
So that's a really good question. So all spacecraft are supposed to be clean when they leave the Earth. In other words, and I'll give you a funny example, after 9/11, we were supposed to deliver one of our instruments to be placed on the spacecraft. And right after 9/11, you could not fly. You know, everybody was grounded.
Right.
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 And we had to carry this peculiar-looking, wired, weird contraption that you could not open. Right. It was in a sealed case. You could not open it. You could not touch it. You could not examine it. Right. Because it had to be clean. And it took, you know, a monumental effort. In the end, I could not even get the FBI. I could not reach the FBI, but we had to have our special security had to get in contact with the FBI and arrange how we were going to transport this flight instrument and get it on an airplane and take it to Europe. But it's so sensitive that when you prepare an instrument in a clean environment, in a clean room, so-called, and then, you know, you preserve it clean, so-called, in the launch environment. You get it out of Earth's atmosphere, and you launch it into any of these planets or moons or any place. It's supposed to be clean of any Earth contamination. The interesting thing about life is that it is unbelievably determined to survive, and we know that life survives. Strange forms of life have been found to exist that only live in clean rooms. So it's an amazing phenomena to me how determined life is to survive and how it really struggles to survive. But life molecules are vastly different than the kind of organic molecules that we see or expect to see right now on on comets. So, you know, ultimately, it's a really good question, but I think if we saw something that actually was closer to life, like was resembled a bacteria, then we would say, and the questions would be, what's the source of this bacteria? You know, is it really something that was transported from a terrestrial environment by way of the spacecraft? But organic has many, you know, there's abiotic organic molecules aplenty in the interstellar medium, and we're curious as do those make any contributions to life on Earth in a biotic environment? And those relationships are difficult to understand. And what we really don't even know is how much abiotic organics also exist on a comet. So this is sort of one of the first baby steps.
Thank you very much, Carol, for your call. Rick is next in Portage. Hi, Rick.
Hi. I was curious as to, since this was launched 10 years ago, is there anything technologically available now that you didn't have access to back then that you wish you did have?
Oh, that's a good question.
You know, these are all sort of one-of-a-kind instruments, and I'll give you an example. The microwave instrument, which is the first time we've ever flown a microwave instrument, this is the first time we've ever miniaturized a technology like that from the giant ones we have circling the Earth to something that you could launch into space, and it took us 20 years to get it miniaturized. So most of these instruments are state-of-the-art. Even if that's a one-of-a-kind kind of instrumentation for space, there aren't that many that are more sophisticated now. The only exception might be the camera, because I would say that the capability of this camera in terms of the megabytes that it returns is about the same as my camera phone. It's kind of funny because I keep thinking, okay, how many pictures are we going to get? It's the same as if I would calculate for my phone. But cameras built for space are advanced already in terms of the technology that it takes to build a camera for the specialized environment of space and what you want to accomplish with that specialized environment of space. So, you know, I would say that pretty much this is a state-of-the-art spacecraft.
We also, I read, and I wonder how much information we're getting and how important this is, allowed Rosetta to pass by a couple asteroids, giving us views we hadn't seen before, and scientific data on asteroids as well. Does that include pictures and more? What are we getting from the asteroids?
So studying an asteroid was part of the charter for Rosetta, but in fact, especially the first asteroid encounter was kind of a test case for how we're going to do this. The data ended up being, so there was a hot pixel. What that means is that in the camera there was a pixel that was giving bad data, but it was a bright. And so since they were using the pictures of the asteroid to actually fly, that bright pixel, the camera images kept jumping around, so the spacecraft kept, so all the pictures were blurry, just a little blurry, not the greatest quality. And some of the other experiments were off. Like they were going to, normally what you would try to do is a gravity experiment to try to understand the gravity field and also to understand the density and so forth. That still ended up being a really exciting discovery because it looks like a rubble pile spin-up. So it's the first ever what they call a YORP object that we've actually encountered in space where it's been pulverized into smaller pieces. And then gravitationally what happens is that they can spin back together and spin up into a tighter, faster self-gravitation situation. And that evidently is what happened with that one. And that's the first, our first time seeing one. Wow, that looks like a YORP object, which formerly only existed on paper.
Hmm.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
The next asteroid proved to be another fascinating object because we did get more data with that one. And some of the data suggested that it was filled with minerals that could only have been formed very, very close to the sun, inside of the orbit of Mercury.
Hmm.
So that gives us a clue. It adds to the sort of forensic evidence that the early solar system was incredibly dynamic. So something caused this rock, which formed very, very close to the sun, to be cast out into the asteroid belt.
Hmm.
Is that because one of the giant planets plowed its way all the way forward? You know, as that's some of the current theories about the origin of the solar system have Jupiter going all the way forward past the orbit of Mercury and then going back out again. It seems crazy.
Yeah.
But evidence like we found with this other asteroid, Lutetia, those are some of the things that have us scratching our heads and wondering whether that theory could possibly be true.
Fascinating. All right, let's play this sound, and then we'll talk about it, and somebody has a question on our Facebook page about it. This was the sound that was sent back very shortly after Philae landed on the comet, and we had never heard this sound before. Where it's coming from just, you know, kind of blows your mind. Here's the sound, and then let's talk about it. As we're listening to that, Dr. Alexander, a message from somebody on Facebook, how was the Philae able to record this sound on the comet? I thought he says that sound did not travel in a vacuum. Does the comet sustain some sort of atmosphere to allow for the transmission of sound?
No, this is this has been translated into audio frequencies for human ears. So this was a signal that was originally at much deeper wavelengths that somebody cleverly just did a wave translation into audio frequencies so we could hear it.
Huh.
It's still fascinating.
Yes.
Okay? It doesn't represent a sound wave, though, that is in the same way that travels through Earth to our ears. And I've forgotten exactly what is the generation of that sound wave, that the waves that were then translated into sound frequencies. I think this is on the descent the plasma instrument, if I remember correctly what the source of this is, was taking measurements. And what I think is incredibly interesting is that it modulates. You can hear
right.
it going up and down
mm-hmm.
and changing.
Yeah.
And as if there's some activity going on in whatever vacuum environment. We know jets are already active on the comet, and so the particles are executing their gyro frequencies and so forth. So we're hearing something going on. And it's active, and I just think that's so fascinating, and I want to know what is the activity that's going on.
Right.
We'll hear more about that.
We will know. We'll find out. From
I'm sure we will.
Good.
Yes, I'm
All
sure
right.
we will.
All right, good, good. Bruce is next in Holman. Hi, Bruce.
Hello.
Hi.
Well, this is certainly a tremendous technological achievement. I do have a question about the solar recharging of the batteries. In all of the animations I've seen of asteroids and time-lapse of other space bodies, they're spinning, they're rotating as they travel through space. It would seem to me that even if the lander is in a shadowed area, if the nucleus of the comet is rotating or spinning, wouldn't it be exposed to sunlight at least partially during, I guess, what you would call the day on the nucleus? Or does the nucleus of this comet not rotate or spin in relationship to the sun at all?
No, you're exactly right. The nucleus is rotating and spinning. And the expectation has always been that the solar panels would be exposed to sunlight at least some portion of the day. But what has happened is that in the crevasse in which the lander finds itself now, most of the solar panels are in shadow. So much less of the expected conversion of sunlight into solar power, you know, with the cells, is possible because many fewer cells are actually exposed to sunlight. And, of course, the sunlight, we're still 3 AU from the sun. So the sun is a tiny glimmer, not, you know, as big as in our sky where we're 1 AU from the sun. We thought that it might take 2 weeks originally to recharge the solar cells, depending on how much dust got on them. Now it looks like it might take 2 to 3 months to recharge the solar the battery, because we don't have as many solar cells exposed.
And how cold is it? We got a temperature, didn't we? I'd heard a couple.
I think it is minus 150 degrees Celsius. I can't remember. It's
right. I think that sounds right.
And
to me
I
too.
Always I know I quoted two numbers, and now I can't remember which is the Celsius and which is the Kelvin. I think it's minus 107. Oh, I can't remember now.
Yeah.
It's pretty cold.
It's cold.
Okay.
It's really cold.
It's pretty cold. Yeah.
Thanks, Bruce, very much for your call. David in Waukesha. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Great show. When you had the sound on from the comet last week, I was pulling into my garage and I heard this sound and I turned my car off and I listened and thought, what in the world? What an amazing thing that Kathleen's been putting on her show. And then when you announced you were going to have Dr. Alexander on, I was just thrilled. So,
great.
I want to ask a couple of quick questions about collaboration. I was watching the ESA, the European Space Agency, people on the website and watching you, Dr. Alexander, for a day or two when this was happening. And I wanted to know how the ESA people get along with NASA and if this project was a good stimulant to have everybody get along instead of competing a little bit better.
Hmm. You know, I think, realistically speaking, we all get along, okay? So there isn't so much competition as there is maybe national pride, so that NASA has maybe a couple decades more experience in space as opposed to ESA, and we're a different culture. So we have learned to be a little bit risk-averse at NASA because we have taken our hits. We've lost some spacecraft, and we, you know, have developed at JPL, we've developed all these incredible ways of managing risk and identifying risk and mitigating risk and trying to protect the taxpayer from having a loss that's not explainable. You weren't careful enough, or you didn't think enough, or you didn't pay attention to safety, or for whatever reason. So we have a lot more staff dedicated towards just making sure we don't make mistakes and things like that. And let's say we might recommend, gee, you ought to have this because that's what we do. And the Europeans are like, well, we don't think we need to do that, and we're going to do it our way. And you know, keep your mouth shut.
Yeah.
And you know, and I think that's fair, right? Why should they have a staff of 60 when they can have three smart guys go off in a room and hammer it out? NASA used to do that. You know, and there are lots of other things that we scratched our heads watching and saying, wow, you know, we would have had, you know, someone who specialized in what we call systems. So, you know, you have in Europe a contribution from Germany, a contribution from France, a contribution from Italy. We would have somebody in the middle making sure that everybody talked to one another so that all the specifications were agreed on, right?
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that you might have the Italians deliver something, a screw or something, that doesn't fit with the frets that were developed by Germany, right? Well, didn't you talk to each other?
Right, right.
You know, so we might recommend, gee, maybe you should talk, and maybe they, and then they might say, look, you know what? We're going to do it our way. We have our way of doing it. It's fine. Keep your nose out of it. And so, you know, I think it's great for us to learn how to be the junior partner, stop trying to tell people that it has to be a certain way. Other people are very smart. They're capable of hammering out something. And we've learned from our mistakes. Sometimes you have to let other people have their own mistakes. That doesn't mean that we didn't do everything we could to make our partnership a success. Okay, every time we really felt like something might lead to something that would really not be a happy solution in terms of success, we did everything we could to make our recommendations and our voices heard. And I think that's what being a good partner is.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, David, very much. When you said that we didn't want to have a failed mission because we didn't think enough, and it got me thinking about thinking, actually, Dr. Alexander. I can't even imagine, because my mind doesn't grasp, and I didn't study physics, I don't have that kind of mind. I can't imagine the number of minds, the number of specialties that had to really think long and long and hard and think enough to make this mission as successful as it has been so far. Was it just a collection of incredible minds?
Well, yes. Yes. You know, you kind of have a nation's best, let's say.
I see.
And I'm not saying that a nation's best is to be found in planetary science. I mean, some of the brightest people go off and do stock market or computers, or, you know, they're not necessarily creating one-of-a-kind instruments to explore space.
Mm-hmm.
But it is an environment where you find people who love those kinds of challenges, who love to develop one-of-a-kind pieces of equipment to do very unique things. And so the very challenge of it sometimes draws out your best and your smartest people.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Dennis in Waukesha. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. This is absolutely fascinating, and to do it over that many millions of miles. But I'm wondering, when this was originally conceived, the idea was conceived, what were the odds of the actual success of the program? And once the landing was completed, did you think you should run out and buy a lottery ticket?
Yeah. I mean, originally there were two landers. One was a German lander called Roland, and another one was a collaboration between the French and NASA called Champollion. And it, as an indication of the odds of landing, NASA decided that the odds were too high, too low, and they pulled out. They said, you know, we don't think this can be done successfully, and we don't want to take the risk. So they pulled out of Champollion. The French still remember it with great bitterness, and the Roland ended up becoming the primary lander, the only lander. Ironically, you know, 10 years later, or I guess 15 years later, because that decision to pull out of the Roland was much long before launch, NASA is back, you know, so happy to have made contributions to a successful landing. And, of course, we, you know, you get over it, right? Get over it, and all different people are involved. So we want to be absolutely thrilled to be participating in this landing. But, it has always been a huge risk. And you, in space science, you need a little bit of luck, and we have been blessed with luck throughout Rosetta's progress here. Mm.
More phone calls in a moment, and here's how you reach this conversation, 800-486-8655. Claudia Alexander is the project manager and project scientist of the U.S. portion of the Rosetta Project, and we were all absolutely captivated by what happened last week, and now we'll learn brand new information about a makeup of a comet, and we hope that it will give us, this is amazing to even say, some idea of how we were formed and whether comets had anything to do about getting water on Earth or with the origin of life on this planet. Ooh-wee! 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Rick is next in Mendota. Hi, Rick.
Hi, I'm enjoying your program very much. About several years ago, or not, probably less than 10 years ago, three meteors struck, I think it was Jupiter, and there were meteors that came out of nowhere, and some amateur astronomer saw them and named them, and they really wreaked havoc on the planet when they hit. And I wondered if this had any, was possibly had an adjunct or connection to the satellite or the missile that just landed on this meteor. Is there, you think it's important for us to be able to do that as like a defensive thing in case a meteor were to come out of nowhere and be a threat to the Earth?
I do think that it's important, not the most important thing, but it is important to continue to build our knowledge so that we can defend ourselves.
And it would appear to me that we'd be, if it took 10 years for this to get to there, and that we'd be a long way from being able to shoot down a comet, wouldn't we?
I mean, part of what you need to know is what's the hardness. Right? How many missiles would you need to cause it to disintegrate into small enough pieces that it wouldn't have a major effect? And so we're learning a lot. You know, we launched a missile back in 2004 called the Deep Impact on Comet Tempel 1. And much to our surprise, it didn't do much to that comet. And I think we didn't learn a hard enough lesson that comets can be very hard. You know, even though they're fluffy and they're low density, so that suggests that, you know, they pull apart real easily. And we saw with Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9, one of them did pull apart really easily. And all of the string of pearls, there must have been 30 of them, crashed into the planet Jupiter. Hmm. And you see these strings of pearls all over other moons. So you know that comets have done that in the past. But nonetheless, trying to learn what these materials are such that you can build an appropriate missile or know how many of them you need, those are all part of the learning process about learning about what these objects are. But I don't expect that to be something that we will learn, you know, in a quick, that's not a quick turnaround kind of lesson.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Rick, very much for your call. Karen in Madison. Hi, Karen.
Hi. First of all, I want to say, Kathleen, you have the best programming on public radio today in the country.
Thank you.
But I'm 63 years old, and I was raised to believe that even as an intelligent student, I could only be a mother or a teacher. And the most exciting thing about this program is that Dr. Alexander is a woman and a scientist, mm-hmm, and a whole person.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just making tears come down my cheeks.
Aww.
Because we've come so far in so little time. And Dr. Alexander, I have to tell you, has such a complete, fun, exciting personality, and I'm so glad our country can raise up people like you.
Oh.
Today.
Oh, I thank you very much, and I'm crying too.
Oh, isn't that nice? What a great phone call.
Cool. Oh. Say that. I really appreciate it.
Oh, now we're all going to start crying. And now we're going to discover how we came about. So it's amazing. But it's interesting because I did read that your parents, you wanted to study something else. And it was your parents who said, if we're going to send you to UC Berkeley, we want you to have a science background, didn't they?
Yeah, well, they did not have science in mind, I can tell you. Okay, they were so disappointed when I continued to go into graduate school. They were like, what? You know, a bachelor's degree is kind of what we had in mind. And what they really had in mind was we lived in the Silicon Valley, and it was kind of the land of Steve Jobs. And so they were thinking computer science, get in technology, and get a job, and get it, have a regular day job that will be secure for you, which was
right.
Actually pretty smart, you know.
Yes.
I wanted to do writing history. My sister got to do it what I wanted to do, which was journalism. She worked for the Wall Street Journal in the middle article. She would write that human interest column, and then she went on to work for the Boston Globe.
Oh.
But the publishing industry collapsed, you know, so... In terms of our parents' vision for let's get you in settled into some regular job that you know gives you a living, then you can go do history. If you want to do history, you can do that in your spare time. If you want to write fiction, you can do that in your spare time. Turns out they were right, okay? And now I find myself giving the same advice to my friends' kids, you know, stop farting around and get a profession that will give you a regular job, and then you can do on the side all the things that you think are interesting, psychology or, you know, whatever. But, yeah, it has been difficult for my parents to realize that science, because it's all the way to the PhD, and then after your PhD, you still aren't earning any money as you do your graduate postdoctoral work and the like. And there's a lot of hours that balance between life and family and work is really, really difficult to maintain. Because you've got it, you know, people are working 10 hours a day,
sure.
90 hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a very, very tough, the publisher parish environment is tough. So I think that has been a really tough one for my parents to finally reconcile.
Right. Oh, they must be so proud of you, though. And I understand that you also, I wonder if they're available, Dr. Alexander, you've written quite a few children's books on space, haven't you?
I have. It's called Windows to Adventure, and there's a bunch of ones in the pipeline to get done. We only have one out. The second one should be out in a few weeks. The first one I was going to try to do in time for the transit of Venus, and we really missed that deadline by quite a bit. But I put out a version, and I didn't like it. So I went and found another book designer, and the new book designer has just done a fabulous job. So the next book is called Which of the Mountains is Greatest of All, and it is fabulous, even if I do say so myself. It's got pictures, it's got cartoons, it's got photographs, it's got technical drawings, and it's fun, and it introduces the science, and I hope other people like it too.
Mm, great. Let's go to one more call. We have about a minute left. Peter in Stoughton. Hi, Peter.
Good afternoon. What is the mass of Philae on the nucleus? I saw on the internet somewhere that it's a little over a gram, and I was wondering if that's just...
No. That is in the gravity environment of the comet. Okay, so that gram is what it weighs on the comet. On Earth, it's more like, I don't know, we've been calling it a washing machine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't imagine lifting up my washing machine the way I lift up a quarter, you know.
Right.
The difference is many thousand times. Let me say one thing before we sign off.
Okay.
And that is that I am the project scientist. I'm no longer the project scientist and project manager. I only did that job in the very early days until we could hire a talented project manager. So I don't want to take anything away from my counterpart, the project manager, who's also done a fabulous job.
Yeah, I don't think you're taking away anything from anybody.
Well, thank
you're
you.
Terrific. Thank you very much for being with us. And I don't know if you're going to be featured. I just happened to notice today that PBS has a show tonight at 9 o'clock on all of this, on the comet. So that'll be fun to watch.
Oh, good. I'll set my DVR as well. That sounds good.
Good. Thank you so much for being with us, Dr.
Okay.
Alexander.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. Dr. Claudia Alexander, and she was with the U.S. portion of the Rosetta Project, and what a fascinating interview that was. We'll be doing other shows on this as more information comes in, because it's a remarkable feat. And I did happen to notice, just, you know, in looking information about what we learned today about Rosetta, that there is a PBS special, and it's at 9 o'clock tonight, at least in the Milwaukee area. So look at, I'm sure it's going to be worth seeing. No doubt about that. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for finding Claudia. I said, K.P., we have to do a show. He said, okay, we'll find somebody, and look who he found. Thanks, K.P., and thanks to Scotty Myers as well for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios.